It is with profound grief and sorrow that I have to report to you that Walter Zany Blaney just passed yesterday. That was on November the 11th, on 2020. He was 92 years old, and he had taken a fall, apparently, about a week ago in his kitchen, and had some bleeding into the brain, in which after he finally got up and got to the hospital, was taken there, and there wasn't really anything that they could do about the stopping the bleeding. Anyhow, that he leaves three wonderful daughters and so many friends and a legacy that that we will all remember. He was more than just a friend to me. In some ways, that he was like a father. That I could go on and just give a lot of really great accolades as to how great he was and to me and such a friend and somebody who we missed. I'm uncertain at this point anything about any any kind of services that they're going to be having, but I'm sure that they're, even during this difficult time we're living in then right now here in 2020, that there might be something but scheduled. But anyhow, this is something that is another tragic loss in our community that seems to be compounding loss upon loss this past year, and we keep wondering, when is this going to end? And perhaps that's just inevitability of life, that the longer we live, that the more friends that we have, that eventually that we're all going to be lost and move on and let the next generation come on. I'm also thankful that on many occasions that I've had Walter as a guest on the podcast. We've had many episodes together where he has been featured. There have been times in which we have caught up with each other at conventions, and he's given me some stories and just delighted us all. And I would encourage you to go back just into the archives, or perhaps easier still, if you just go to themagicwordpodcast.com and there's a search bar and just type in Walter Blaney or Walter Zany Blaney. And his name will pop up several times, and you can listen to some of his memoirs and so many different things. I mean, from his conspiracy theories on the Kennedy assassination all the way to an infamous story with David Hoy when he thought he was on the radio live, and it was rather funny, plus the development of his levitation and his hoop. And so many other stories. Again, someone who will be sorrowfully missed in our community, but this just happened, and so I thought that I would put this on here in the front of the podcast to alert you all to this to his passing. So, aloha, old friend.
This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. This week's episode is brought to you again by our sponsor, the Yankee Gathering 2020, which is a convention for the New England Magic Collectors Association. That's NEMCA, the NEMCA.com. And there, if you go to the NEMCA.com, you can find out more information about this weekend's convention. It's going to be November the 14th and 15th, and so it's coming up just right around the corner here in a few days, so you do not want to miss that. And it will be an online convention this year, and it's going to be featuring not one, but two special guests of honor. And all this information is actually going to be on our website if you go to themagicwordpodcast.com and just click on the convention guide, magic convention guide, and there you will see a little ad for them, as well as a little audio trailer that goes with Michael Mayo, and he tells you a little bit more about the convention, actually about 8 minutes worth of details on what's coming up and what you can expect at the convention this weekend. Sounds like it's going to be just a whole heck of a lot of fun, and he'll tell us a little bit about it also a little bit later here in the podcast. Speaking of this podcast, this week I'm really honored to have my friend as a guest, who is Ariane Black. Now, Ariane is a Las Vegas magician who happens to be residing right now in Canada, and where she's doing actually this cooking class. This is, I say a class, it's called Arian Black's Magic Kitchen, and it's a Facebook page. And if you're interested in getting some quick recipes using 8 items or less and something that you can whip up fairly quickly, I suggest if you just check out her Facebook page. Again, just do a search for Arian Black's Magic Kitchen, and she has it every Friday afternoon, and it's pretty cool. Anyhow, lots of really good things there, but she is also a person who has won the Female Magician of the Decade when she was residing in Las Vegas, and she had had her own one-person show. And also, she's writing a book about some of the female magicians from the past, and she talks quite a bit about that on the first part of this episode. And then on the second part, she talks more about her career and also some suggestions if you're thinking about trying to get into Las Vegas, and particularly if you're a woman, some of the obstacles that she has faced. And it's quite an interesting conversation we have, and it's very candid, and I think that you will enjoy this week's episode. So let me step aside and introduce my guest. Please welcome Ms. Arian Black here on The Magic Word. Well, today I have with me a guest who is from Canada, actually, and she resides typically in Las Vegas, where she has had shows in the past and does a lot of shows out of Las Vegas as well, that are a lot of things that are not only corporate work, as a lot of us do, but also things for the government, and a lot of charity shows that she's done then as well. She was also the person who was Magician of the Year in 2011 by the International Conclave of Illusionists, and then also has done a lot of television shows and appearances then as well, and she had also been awarded the honor of Magician of the Decade by the International Divas of Magic. So please welcome my guest here today, Ms. Arian Black. Hey, Arian, how are you?
Hey, Scott. Nice to see you.
Good seeing you here as well. So glad that you had some time to join us about this. And I was just mentioning about the Magician of the Decade, and so that's pretty impressive, certainly. And so was that a pretty big surprise whenever that you got that honor?
Yeah, it was. I was amazed and thrilled. It's really nice to be not just honored, but acknowledged by your peers.
Of course. Yeah. I assume it came with a nice trophy.
It did. It's in my magic room.
Yeah. Cool. So when you had received that, obviously made the news, and you tried to do as much as you can, of course, to promote that as well.
I did. And it's funny because the award lasted longer than the Divas of Magic. So
that's funny. So were there other awards that were given by the Divas of Magic?
There were. Kristen Johnson got one for being an escape artist the same year. So and I'm trying to think of some of the others. I think June Horowitz was given an award for, you know,
She was the international president.
Her lifetime achievements.
Yeah. She has done certainly so much.
She has. Amazing
had.
Woman.
Yeah. She certainly was.
I know. But she had such an amazing career, and people know so little about her, which is sad.
That's true. And she was a good friend of mine, and long before that she had become or actually gotten involved on the board with the International Brotherhood of Magicians and everything. But yeah, the close-up that she had done, and I had seen her at the 4F convention several times, as well as other places. And there was, many years ago, I found some watches that were available. Like, there's a place in part of Houston here where that they have like knockoff purses and, you know, cheaper kinds of stuff like that, I guess, that you'd normally find like on the streets in New York or whatever. Well, there was a place that was selling a bunch of watches, and they had different kinds of watch faces, like the Queen of Hearts or Jack of Clubs and whatever. It was really a nice female watch. And so I bought a few of those, and she had one. I got one for her, and she wore that. Every time she saw me, she'd say, "Scott, still wearing my watch. It's still wearing good." She always loved that watch. I think she did some tricks with it also to have a card selected, and that would match the one that was on her watch. That was kind of cool.
Yeah.
She was just a wonderful person. So the Divas of Magic. So there was a show, as I recall, that was at the San Remo or somewhere way back when.
that Steve Daly, I think, was involved with. Is that the same kind of a group?
That was Showgirls of Magic.
Showgirls of Magic. That's right. Completely different. Okay.
Completely different. Yes.
So what was the Divas of Magic?
It was an organization kind of like Magic Gals. And so your listeners probably don't know what Magic Gals was. But in the late 1930s and the 40s, there was an organization that was all female magicians. Mm-hmm. And Jerry Larson, which is Bill Larson and, you know, Milt Larson's mother, she was one of the founding members. And it was this group of female magicians, and they would hand out magic wands. And so if you find a magic wand that has Magic Gals on it,
yeah,
it's one of like maybe 50 wands that are out there.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. So there are very few ladies who were involved with that organization at the time.
Correct. And it lasted, that organization lasted about 15, maybe 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
They did have one honorary male member.
Okay, who was that?
I'd have to look at my notes.
I was wondering if that might have been Bill Larson.
No, it wasn't a Larson boy.
Okay.
But
okay.
Yeah, and so there's a couple photos of these women that when they got together and stuff. One it was taken in the lawn outside in the front of the Magic Castle.
Mm-hmm.
And it has about 10 women in the photo.
Now, when you say the castle, was it actually there or was it in front of Brookledge?
Oh, I'm sorry. It would have been Brookledge.
Right, which is where the Larsons lived. Yeah.
Right.
Because this was before the castle actually was built.
Right.
Well, I should say it became the Magic Castle. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You're right. I'm sorry.
That's right.
But, And so it's just I love the history of women in magic because we've been around for so long.
Tell me a little bit about that. What have you researched? What have you found?
I have found so much. So I've been working on a book, and it's just a coffee table book.
Mm-hmm.
And it's female magicians, and it's going from like the 1600s up to 1970s.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I did that was because I want to be able to do a second book, but I don't want to do a book that is all encompassing of female magicians and then have like 30 or 40 women contact me and go, how come I'm not included?
Good point. Yep, sure.
And so if I do one book and get great success with that, then I have the opportunity to do the second book and really make sure that I include all the women that, you know, really deserve to be featured in it.
Well, there's been a proliferation of women in magic. Since 1970, certainly. I think prior to that, there have been one or two, Susie Wanda's or several others.
Oh, no.
Really?
So I have so many from the 1800s.
See, Talma is the first one I can think of.
Okay, so there's Paulina, and she's from, I think she's from Finland. I have to look at my notes. Which are in my phone, and I'm talking to you on my phone right now. So there's Paulina, and she was a huge, huge star. She toured all over, like Sweden and Norway and Finland and just everywhere. I mean, and the press clippings, everything of her. And she was about 20, 26 in that age range when she was touring.
Mm-hmm.
She met a photographer, married him, and stopped doing magic. She was at the height of this huge career. She completely stopped doing magic. She started helping her husband in the photo studio. She started taking photos herself and ended up, when her husband passed away, taking over the photo studio and still running it for several years. She cut magic out of her life so much so her children had no idea she'd ever done a magic trick.
Wow.
And her grandchildren, when they were researching, because there's two books now done about her. And when the researchers were doing the books, the researcher was doing the first book, the grandchildren had no idea. And then one of her grandchildren wrote another book about the grandmother, with magic and stuff.
So when she toured, was it just across the United States or did she tour internationally or through Canada?
No, she toured in, like I said, Finland, Norway, Sweden. You know, all of that area.
Yeah,
but she was
But she didn't come over internationally. I mean, into the U.S. and so mainly European and Scandinavian countries. Right. I guess that's what I mean.
Yeah, because she was touring around 1880. And then there's a whole bunch. And so, like, everybody knows the name Okito.
Sure.
But the first Bamber. Person, right, the Bamber. And actually, the grandson lives in Hawaii. I've met him. Really nice guy. Huh. Yeah. Yeah.
Does he have really some pretty nice good stories? Guy.
He does. Huh. He does have great stories.
So he's embraced his heritage.
He doesn't have anything to do with magic.
Huh.
He saw one of my shows and he came up to me afterwards and he said, it was like Michael Bamberg. And he goes, do you know my last name? And I go, yeah, I do. And he goes, yeah, that was my grandfather. Wow. Okay. So back to Okito.
Yeah.
So everybody knows that name. People don't know the name Okita. So the original person, the very first person to dress in Asian garb mm-hmm. and do a show as a faux Asian person was Okita, which was Clementine's mother. And in the posters of Okita, you will see a small girl, and that's Clementine. And Clementine is Ionia.
Hmm. The same person, yeah, because I've seen, of course, the famous Ionia posters.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Mm-hmm. So her mother was Charles, I can't think of the last name, but and he owned a magic shop. But the mother, and that's how the mother and father met. The mother was a touring, successful female magician. And so that was the 1800s.
Mm-hmm.
Zirka is another one from Italy. She did a manipulation act with cigarettes. She ended up in an insane asylum where she died alone and blind. There was Madame Dolinsky, who was one of the first people to be shot and killed doing the bullet catch. When she died, the last words, her recorded last words were, "Husband, you've killed me."
Hmm.
She didn't want to do the show. She wasn't feeling very well. And they had, like a month or two prior, had just lost their child because this was 1810, 1820, right in there. And they had just lost their child. She found out that she was pregnant with their second child, so she wasn't feeling well. Mm-hmm. And begged him not to do the show. But they had to because they were it was a command performance for royalty, and they were at the palace. And so they couldn't cancel the show. And when they did the bullet catch, she would stand in front of the firing squad, and the firing squad would shoot at her. And mm-hmm. one of the gentlemen didn't load his gun right and shot and killed her.
Wow. Wow.
And so there's all these women, all these amazing, amazing women who have these crazy, wonderful stories. Jenny. There was this girl, Jenny, who toured New Zealand, and she was 19, and she had this big touring show, and this was like, 1860 or so. And when she toured, she had these, instead of traveling with big trucks, she would travel with the covered wagons. And it was raining, and she was going from one town to the next, and they had to cross a river. And when they were crossing the river because of the rain, it was deeper than they thought it was, and it swept the entire show, the cast, crew, everybody down the river, and she drowned.
And how old was she at the time when she passed?
19.
So she only toured for a year or so.
Yeah, she toured for a couple years. Yeah.
Well, another interesting story I would think would be not just what they did, what they accomplished, but just how they lived at that time. Because how women were treated, I would imagine, the 1800s would not be the same as a man who would be traveling from one dusty hotel to another, and how that she would have so much luggage with all the illusions and everything to carry, and having men to do this I just think that it would be so difficult, I mean, super difficult for a woman in particular back then.
Right. Think about it being super difficult until about 1924, mm-hmm. when women were finally given the right to vote.
Okay.
Because prior to that, most countries, if you were a woman, You weren't allowed to travel unless you had permission from either your husband or your father.
Mm-hmm.
And so imagine Ionia coming to America to do shows. So she's toured all over Europe, and her father has sent the show over to the United States. And she arrives here only to find out that the theater that they're performing at has closed.
Mm-hmm.
And now she's getting telegrams, and she's got her son with her, because she had a child at 16 with a circus animal trainer.
Okay.
That's who she had married.
Yeah.
And she was divorced by now. So she's single, has a child, not allowed to vote. The theater that she's come to has closed. She's 20, you know, maybe 22, 23 about at this time.
Mm-hmm.
And her father is sending her messages saying, find another theater, get the show up and running, find another theater. Now, she doesn't have any rights. She doesn't. What businessman is going to talk to her? Theaters are generally booked at this time, 6 months to a year out.
Mm-hmm.
So unless a show falls out and they're scrambling to replace it, right?
She has no place to go.
She has no place to go. Her father blamed her and sold off all the magic props and basically told her to find her own way back to Europe.
Holy moly.
Okay. Yeah. And, you know, everything ended up fine. She ended up marrying, like, you know, a prince and, you know.
Cinderella became, story from there, huh? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, and her son is like not an astrophysicist, but like a math genius.
Hmm.
Yeah, and he had wonderful stories about his mother.
And what year would that have been, approximately? You say that 1920?
Ionia was around 1910, 1920, somewhere in there.
Early 1900s?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Wow. Interesting.
I mean, unfortunately, so I have over 200 women.
I was about to ask you about how many you think. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so at a certain point, they all start to blend in together, except for the ones that I'm working on immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them, the information is so hard to find. It is so hard to find. There's very little about it in magic, publications, for whatever reason, they didn't
write. I was
going to
say, why didn't they talk about women back then? Is it, were they prejudiced, chauvinistic?
Well,
all those?
All of the above. You know, look at the magic circle. Yeah, they didn't allow women in until 1980.
It was right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so they didn't. If they did write about a woman, it was, they had gone to see a show and there happened to be a woman in it.
And that's it, not what she did.
Right.
Wow.
And so there is also this weird underlying subtext of women in magic. And it dates back to the 1600s and stuff when people were burned at the stake for being a witch.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when women who wanted to practice magic tricks, they weren't, you know, they were treated like they were witches.
But men were not treated like warlocks. In other words, I don't recall the warlock trials and having men who were burned at the stake. They were just women.
Correct.
Huh.
Yep.
Hadn't thought about that.
Now, there were men that were burned at the stake.
Oh, were there?
Mm-hmm. But they're not really talked about, are they?
No, no.
And so, okay. And so think about it this way also. So one of the most famous magicians in literary history is Merlin, right?
Correct.
Every magician knows Merlin. In fact, I can see a wizard behind you that people would look at and say that's probably like a Merlin, right?
Right, right. Long beard and a conical hat and all that, right? Mm-hmm.
Yep. So what they forget is that Merlin's nemesis that was considered the best magician, even better than Merlin,
mm-hmm.
was Morgana.
Yes.
And instead of her being a hero, she was villainized.
She was cast as a villain. That's for, yeah, I recall. Guys, I've read Le Morte d'Arthur. of the story of King Arthur and Camelot and all that. And I remember Morgana and all that, how that she was cast and her son and all that. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Right. And yet, if you look at the story of Morgana, she had a horrible life. I mean, she was raped and abused and, you know, all these things. And yet they expected her to come out like a normal person.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, but she was more powerful than Merlin. And so because of that, they had to destroy her.
Interesting. Yeah, because he was always the more powerful. He's the one who had created Stonehenge and everything else, it seems like, and they attribute to Merlin.
Right. And so, you know, so let's go back to real life, though. So we've got women that when people look at them, they think of, you know, witches, and they think that they're evil and bad. And then, you know, we look at the fact that they can't travel and do things without permission from a man. And you know, a lot of women in the 1800s and stuff ended up doing spiritualism.
That's true. Yeah. I think about, was it Eva Marie? Yeah.
Anna Eva Fay.
Fay. Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So she had a son, and because there's two, Anna Fays, and, the second one is the daughter-in-law. And the daughter-in-law has the most amazing story. So several years after her son and the daughter-in-law were married, Anna Eva Fay's son passed away under mysterious circumstances. People think that the daughter-in-law killed him. But so the son taught the daughter-in-law how to do the act. And that's why she started, and she started... She took the name Anna Eva so that she could play off of the notoriety of the mother-in-law.
Right.
But she was arrested for bad checks and not paying theaters and all sorts of things. She was a real shyster.
A swindler and a con man.
Yep. Yeah. Whereas the original one, the mother, you know, she did it as an act, and she was really well known and people loved her. And it's funny because, you know, this daughter-in-law really tarnished the name.
I wasn't aware that there were the two. So, but the original one, I would think that any of those would be really con men or shysters because of what they were trying to do and take advantage of some people who had lost loved ones, particularly in World War One or whatever around that time. But there was also a religion that had been built up around that as well, which there are true believers in that.
Like Sir
even still today.
Conan Doyle was a true believer.
Correct.
Edison was a true believer.
Yeah.
Edison in his basement built this giant light bulb because he thought that he could capture spirits in it.
I don't remember that story. That's interesting. So he could capture spirits in this light bulb. Okay.
That's what he was trying to do. He was trying to capture spirits.
Wonder how that worked out for him.
I don't think it worked out very well.
Well, he was busy battling Tesla on the other front, which unfortunately the Tesla lost, which is another bad story about all that. Well, another, I mentioned Talma with Talma Leroy and Bosco, that she was not just well-known, but there's a lot of information about her. And apparently I understand that she was just a wonderful coin manipulator.
Yeah, she was. She would go and do shows on her own without her husband because she was so well-known with the coins. And, you know, there's that famous poster of where it's just her hand.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like this. Well, it's the back. And then the coins are up in the air.
Yes.
And, you know, yeah. And I don't know if you've ever seen photos of her. Stunning girl.
She was a beautiful young woman, yes.
Yeah. And I, you know, there's this weird thing of she... She was a magician in her own right, but she married a magician and she worked in his show as his assistant and did her own spot. as a female magician, that upsets me because I'm like, how can you subjugate yourself and be your husband's assistant when you are so much more?
Also, I would think that she would have been an equal partner, or should have been. And I thought she was billed as an equal partner with Bosco.
She was billed as an equal partner, but if you saw the show, she was not an equal partner.
Oh,
she was his assistant.
Hmm.
She handed him props. She did the levitation, all of that.
Hmm.
I get it. It meant that they had one less cast member. You know, they didn't have to pay an assistant to do that. And another female magician that did the same thing was Liska, who was married to Raymond.
Mm-hmm. I remember Raymond, but I don't remember Liska.
Liska was his wife, and she was a female magician. And she ended up marrying Raymond was – he was another person who didn't pay the theaters, left debts everywhere he went.
He was in Australia, is that right?
Nope. Raymond was the great Raymond. He was in Europe and the United States. He toured all over. So he would always travel with his wife and two assistants. And one of his assistants for a while was Will Rock, who was a magician who bought like the Thurston show and toured with that, during the war. And so one of his other assistants was, Walter Gibson.
Okay.
The writer.
Yep. Who wrote The Shadow.
Yep.
Radio broadcast.
Yeah. But how many magic books did he write?
I've got several back over there in my library.
Right. Raymond was also, he used to beat Liska.
Physically.
Huh. Yeah. If you have the Will Rock book, it talks about that. Because Will Rock was in love with Liska. And so was Walter, and Walter ended up marrying Liska. And when she married him, that's when her magic career flourished, because then she started doing shows just as herself,
She was independent, basically.
Right. Yeah, and Walter encouraged that for her.
Wow, that was great.
Another female magician that married a magician was Minerva. She married Jarrett. The Jarrett base.
Sure.
And their marriage lasted like 3 years because they were like fire and ice.
Mm-hmm.
She was a world famous escape artist.
So you said you have about 200 or so ladies until 1970.
Yep.
And I would think that since then there have been probably at least another 200 or more that you could write about, because we have had the expansion of close-up magic, which was not part of what used to be magic back then.
Right. Okay. Herman. So everybody
Adele.
Knows the name. Adelaide.
Yeah.
The interesting thing about her is, so her husband did the show for 20 years. She ran the show for 35 years. And even when the warehouse burnt down, she had shows that she had was booked to do, theater shows 2 weeks after the fire.
Mm-hmm.
And the fire was started by a security guy who was running a still in the back of the warehouse.
Intentionally. Was it intentional or just the still caught fire?
Accidentally. The still caught fire.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thought maybe they were losing money or something, and they decided.
He was doing it on the side.
Hmm.
And when it burnt down, I mean, she lost costumes, props, all the animals were stored there. She lost the entire show because the entire warehouse burnt down.
Wow.
And so she had these shows to do 2 weeks later. So one of the people that came to her rescue was Houdini. He gave her props so that she could be back out on the road.
Wow.
And so think about that in today's terms. So imagine if my warehouse burnt down and somebody like Copperfield coming to my rescue. That's what it would be like.
Hmm. I think there are several magicians who are not as well known for their philanthropic endeavors like Copperfield. I know that he has done a lot, but back then too.
Copperfield doesn't talk about his
philanthropic. No, he doesn't. I know of some things, and he's greater than most people know.
Oh, he really is. He really is. Okay, so, but you were talking about close-up magic and the explosion of close-up magic. So, let's go back to Herman.
Yeah.
And let's go back to, not Adelaide, but Herman. Okay, so, when he traveled, because he loved doing close-up magic, too. He was very, I mean, he was a master magician. For me, a master magician is somebody who does everything. Close-up, parlor, stage, everything, right?
Right, yes.
And so he was the epitome of a master magician. And he was in Belgium. And the Queen of Belgium saw him doing magic and hired him to teach her card tricks. And if you went to the palace, you were entertained by the queen and she would do card tricks for you.
How cool is that, that she had learned from Herman?
Yep.
Hmm. Well.
Yep. So, you know.
So he was doing a lot of close-up, but still, close-up was not, really didn't come into its own until certainly the 20th century. Well, except for, let me say, street performing. Obviously, that there were street performers and doing cups and balls and everything.
I was just going to say that street performing's been around forever, and that's close-up.
Correct.
I think bar magicians have been around forever, and that's close-up.
True. I just haven't heard or read any books of saloon barkeeps from the 1800s who were doing close-up back
then. I don't think, just like you don't know the names of street magicians because you've only seen drawings. That's why you know about it. But you don't know any names, do you?
But I'm just wondering if they had, well, few if any, but they would have probably come in off the street to work a saloon and perhaps, but I wonder how the tipping came about. That could be a whole different subject. That's interesting to think about.
Yeah.
About magicians actually coming in from being street performers to working behind a bar and doing, or even doing restaurants or doing bars and working for tips and things, how that, because they were working on the street for tips and just kind of came inside and how that evolved and when that would have come about. I'm sure that someone out there will.
Because card tricks have been around forever.
As long as there have been cards, that's true.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so they had to have had some place to do those card tricks.
Aside from just on the street. Yeah, good point. I guess that's true. Well, what I was going to say, though, is that in the past, that there were not, there wasn't a proliferation, I guess, of close-up magicians as there are today, certainly. And I'm carrying that forward then when you're saying that from 1970 forward, that there were probably a lot more female magicians who can be included in your next book because there are women, let's say like Lisa Menna, who's been doing, well, there's a master magician for you that does a little bit of everything, but she also is doing close-up and excellent in close-up and doing trade shows and that kind of a thing. So,
And her philanthropic pastime is
actually
it's not even for her. It's not a pastime. It's a passion.
It is a passion and a lifestyle. And that's just the way that she is. And of course, she had just recently won an award from the Academy of Magical Arts for her in recognition for her work with that. And so, I had she's a longtime friend and known her since high school. And she was on a previous episode, but I'm just saying her, like several others, I'm sure would be kind of hard for you to actually, leave out someone accidentally, who may not be as well known. So how would you determine which one goes in? And well, I know you don't want to leave any out, but at what point?
I don't want to leave any out. Okay. So, I'm not, cause there is, and her name just escaped me as I went to say it. There is a woman who is writing a hard-hitting book. She's an escape artist. And she's been doing research for years about women in magic. I am not doing that book. I wish her book was out so that I could reference her book. I am doing a coffee table book. So...
Here's going to be more of a fluff piece, and it'll just be a few things as opposed to detail about their lives and everything.
Okay. Correct.
Yeah, and photos and whatnot. Mm-hmm.
Photos, the posters, maybe some press clippings, because for the women in the 1800s, most of what we have is press clippings. as opposed to, you know, photos, because photography was extremely expensive back then,
right.
And not everybody had photos, but there are like line drawings and things like that. And so, yeah, it's getting all of that information and just giving a basic outline of a person, and the gist of their lives. And so when we come to do the second book, where it's more recent, then we do have the ability to include as many people as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a coffee table book.
Right.
Even if it's, you know, one person gets a page, you know, with a publicity photo and a byline, and, you know, and then certain people are featured, because you can't do a magic book without having somebody like Melinda.
Right.
Like her or hate her, she had a show in Vegas for 9 years.
And she was married to Lance Burton for, what?
Six months.
I was going to say 9 months. Okay, 6 months, was that all?
Yeah. Yeah.
I always thought that was more for publicity.
No.
Mm-mm. Hmm.
It's a really sad story. And you'll have to ask other people about it.
Okay, we'll leave it at that. But I know that she has, since remarried, has children and really kind of out of magic at this point.
Well, she got married, had children. It's what she really wanted. She really wanted to be a mother.
Yeah.
And so she's got two beautiful children. And then when the housing market crashed in 2008,
mm-hmm.
They ran into difficulties, mostly because of, you know, people were losing jobs and everything else. And he just, her husband at the time, I think they're still married, actually. But, you know, he was working in the restaurant industry and restaurants were opening and closing. And it was just a nightmare for them.
In and around Las Vegas?
Yeah.
Okay.
They were in California at the time. So they did move back to Vegas, and Melinda started working in the Ultimate Variety Show,
mm-hmm.
so that they had some income. And I think that about, actually maybe a year ago, she retired from V.
Okay, so she was performing up until just recently.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. Mm. And, you know, she was doing a nice little spot. Her favorite trick to do was the zombie ball.
Really? Was it just the typical zombie, or did you have something different? Was it just...
No, it was just the typical zombie. And it's funny because it was one of the most beautiful tricks that she did. And part of what made it beautiful was you could tell she loved performing it.
Yeah, instead of the larger illusions. I saw her show in Atlantic City many years ago, full evening show, and it was very good. Yeah, she was quite an entertainer. This week's episode of the Magic Word Podcast is brought to you by the Yankee Gathering 2020, which will be coming up just this weekend, November the 14th and 15th. And I've got with me right now, telling us a little bit more about it, Michael Mayo. Hey, Michael.
How you doing, Scott?
Fantastic. Thank you very much for joining us here real quick to tell us some more information. This is coming up and getting more and more excited. I know that you guys are excited about some people who are going to be lecturing, and you're going to be having these breakout sessions, live Q&A sessions. You're going to have video tours of private collections, which you normally couldn't do. Tell me about a 3D walk around. How does that work?
We actually have a 3D tour of our headquarters and meeting place for the New England Magic Collectors Association, the Ashland Magic Barn here in Massachusetts. It's really one of a kind place that Peter Lentros and George Lentros's father kind of built, and it's got magic history in pretty much every corner, as well as some special items that you won't see anywhere else.
So I understand on Sunday that there will be an auction that's going to be run by Potter & Potter, and Gabe Fiore is going to be handling that, and there might be some things relating to some of the artifacts discussed by the lectures?
Yes, actually, yeah. He's trying to put together a catalog that revolves around some of the talks that are going to be taking place. We have some great talks by Terry Roses, Tom Ewing, Eddie Dawes, Laura London, Margaret Steele. It's a real... we're really excited about the program that was put together.
That sounds fantastic. So for people who haven't registered yet, again, it's only $25, which is less than a tenth of a price of what it normally costs to register for this fantastic convention. And you say this is one of the oldest running conventions.
Yes, one of the oldest running Magic History conventions and organizations, actually, is ours. And also, all this content is going to be available for 7 days, too. So for anybody in different time zones, or if you want to rewatch certain things, it's available for you to do for 7 days.
And you're going to be using a different format than Zoom, which should be even better.
Yes, a little bit more of a formal. It's for online conventions specifically, and everything is right there on that one page. No hopping around to different sites or anything. It's all pretty much contained and very easy to navigate.
That sounds great. So where can people go to register right now?
You can go to NEMCA.com, that's NEMCA.com, or you can find us on our Facebook page, New England Magic Collectors Association, and register there.
Sounds like a lot of fun. And for those people who are listening to this, it's not too late. You've got a couple of days to go and register for the convention, because it happens this weekend, Saturday and Sunday, November the 14th and 15th. You guys need to be there. It will be not just virtually fun. It will be real fun. Join us, won't you? Thanks, Michael.
Thank you, Scott.
Have a great convention. How long was this your show? Is your show, again, you had run this for a while back in Las Vegas, and you were at which casino?
Okay, so in 2003, 2004, I was at Fitzgerald's doing my show there.
Yeah.
And then I went to...
that was a smaller showroom. Fitzgerald's.
It was.
Yeah.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And then 2010, I went to the Westin. And in between there, I was doing shows like Splash and stuff, which was super
fun. As a variety
yeah,
type
I was,
of...
I was yeah. the variety act in mm-hmm. the show. You know, to be part of the cast of Splash is pretty amazing.
Why so?
When you think about all the famous magicians that have been in Splash.
Name
you
a
know,
few.
Shimada, mm-hmm. Kevin James, Jason Byrne, the Barclay Shaw.
Mm-hmm.
It's mind-boggling to think about my name being mixed in with those.
Was that like a 12-minute act, basically, or how long did you do?
Oh,
in that.
So the story is kind of interesting. I got the part because they had a problem with an act and they were fired overnight. And so at midnight, I got a call and they said, can you be here tomorrow as a fill-in act? And I said, sure. I got there. I had an hour to load in, set up, rehearse. It's a union room, so you can't put your prop out on stage yourself. You have to let somebody mm-hmm. else do it.
Mm-hmm.
All of it, I had an hour. And then the curtain, you know, closes and they let the audience in. So I do the come in, do the rehearsal. Everything is set and fine. And I don't even know where I'm starting in the show. I don't even. Yeah.
First, last, middle, whereabouts you're going to be. Yeah,
yeah.
Just they'll say, here she is. And then you say, OK, I guess I'm ready.
Right.
Crushed out on
so
stage.
I only had to do 3.5 minutes.
OK.
And so the guy comes out, sets my table. I go out. As I'm walking out across the stage, I hear behind me, behind the curtain, because
mm-hmm.
they're setting the ice. I hear behind me a voice saying, hey, really sorry. I tripped going out, so I fell, and everything in your table's in. I don't know if it's in the right spot.
Wonderful. For your first appearance over there, and they've tipped your table, okay?
Yeah. So,
No pressure.
So I'm looking at my table, and nothing. Nothing's where it should be. And, like, candles have sprung open, and, I mean, it was a nightmare. So I'm looking, and you know how you do that little glance? And because I'm looking going, okay, what can I do next? And so I walked off stage and I was so upset. I was so upset because it wasn't my act. And keep in mind, I slowed everything down.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I just took much longer to do things. If I'm running the scarf through my hand, I run it through an extra time,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
all those things. And I'm like, oh, well, I'm only here as a fill-in act for like a couple days till they get obviously a professional. Yeah. And yeah. And this guy comes backstage and he goes, hey, the owner of the show just sent me back here. He wants to know if you can do more than 3.5 minutes. And I said, of course I can. And he goes, great. Can you do 5 minutes? I said, sure, I can do 5 minutes. And he goes, can you change your costume? And I said, what do you mean? And he goes, well, you're wearing a pink jacket in front of a red curtain. Can you change your costume? And I said, well, am I going to be here longer than a couple days? And he goes, yeah, of course.
And so in his mind, you were already the new act.
Yeah. And so I became the permanent act in that spot.
And how long did that run?
That ran for just over a year before I was replaced by Dirk Arthur, mm-hmm. who came in for about the same amount of money and did 16 minutes with cats.
I was going to say he had the big cats, as I recall. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, when
and you... I'm like, you're coming in with cats. Why are you coming in for the same amount of money? This is insane.
Mm-hmm. He had a lot more expenses than you did, I'm sure.
Yeah. Insane. Yeah.
Wow. Was that about the time whenever that the money changed in Vegas? Because I know that it was good, and then it kind of, when it fell.
Money was already starting to change in Vegas mm-hmm. at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And you just, you know, for a while there, variety spots, you know, we used to be able to get 35 to 5,000 a week.
Mm-hmm.
And then it went to 25, and then it went to, 15, 16, and then it went to 1,000, and at a certain point, so around the 25, I said, I'm out of here. I can't, you know, these
shows.
You
can't make a living at that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I recall something about the Greek Isles towards the end that they were pretty much saying that if you want to put on your resume that you worked in Las Vegas, you can come and work on our show. We're not going to pay you, but you get the credibility of saying you've been on the casino stage.
Yep.
That's yep. true, huh?
So, yeah. I worked in this one show where there was a new dancer in the show every week, and dancers would stay in the show for like a couple weeks and then quit. Because they just wanted it on their resume that they'd worked in a Vegas show and,
they weren't being paid.
As soon as they weren't paid, the dancers wouldn't show up.
Now that was also probably around the time they started four-walling. As I recall, speaking of Melinda, again, that David Sachs, her brother, I guess, was kind of the one that kind of started that fad, if you will, of four-walling.
No, it wasn't David. It was his mother.
His mother. Okay.
It was Bonnie Sachs that started that. Mm-hmm. And not only did they start that, they started with the ticket brokers.
Can you explain that process for people who are listening that are saying, wait a minute, you're talking something outside my league?
The four-walling or the ticket brokers?
Both of those.
Okay. So four-walling is when you pay your cast, your crew, the theater, your advertising. Mm-hmm. And I call it actually six-walling because when you're paying for the floor that you're standing on and the ceiling with the lights, mm-hmm. you're paying for everything.
Inside the cube. Yeah.
Right. Yep.
The floor and the ceiling too.
Traditionally in Vegas, shows were a write-off, and casinos were proud to have the best show on the strip because that show would bring people into their casino and people would gamble and, you know, say they had gone to see this show and, you know, it was something to be proud of. And they had all these giant lavish costumes and set pieces and just everything. And you would go to see a spectacle.
An extravaganza. There were a lot of lights and glitz and everything. And they had like Liberace show or whatever type of
right.
thing and showgirls, et cetera.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And with four walling, you can't afford that. You can't mm-hmm. afford to have the huge sets and props and, you know, 80 dancers on stage plus 10 singers, you know, as well as variety acts. You can't afford that.
Right.
And so now casinos don't care what the show is, as long as there's something in the theater that is paying them rent. And when they're charging anywhere from $5,000 to $10,000 a week rent,
mm-hmm.
and now you have to pay for your advertising, and some shows, the advertising costs are like $10,000 or more a month. You know, if you want a billboard, that's $3,000, and that doesn't guarantee that you're going to be on a billboard that's actually seen by people coming out of the airport. And
plus the unions, because some houses are still union.
Yep. So now you've got to pay for union people to be there, and you've got a minimum of how many union people, and you've got to pay your cast, and you've got to pay, you know, for maintaining the costumes, and the list goes on and on and on. And, you know,
you have
by
to have deep
time,
pockets. If you're
going
to be going
deep pockets.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it takes about 18 months for a show to break even. So the last show that I had three dancers, a variety act, and myself. So there was like six of us in the cast.
Okay. Big Illusions?
And, I had like two Big Illusions. Because it was a medium-sized room. So, you know, if you play things big, they look big. As opposed to just having big things that, when, especially when there's no wing space.
And which casino was that? Where you?
That was the Westin.
Okay.
And I was breaking even at like 3.5 months.
Were you focused more? That's pretty darn good. Actually, 3.5 months.
It was.
Were you focused on just your magic, and then you had a manager who was really dealing with the money and the advertising and everything, or were you trying to do it all?
I did it all.
Oh my goodness!
I did it all. And so, at 3.5 months, we were just starting to break even.
Mm-hmm.
And I was also at that breaking point because I was doing it all. And keep in mind, I'd also broken my foot a month before the show opened.
Oh, great.
Yeah, and I had to go in and have surgery to have the foot fixed. So I spent the first couple weeks of the show wearing special shoes just so that I could walk on stage without crutches or anything.
Hmm.
And the doctor did a friggin' awesome job on my foot, by the way. Yeah.
So you didn't injure it further by actually doing the shows.
You know what? I probably did, and I'll probably feel it as I get older and arthritis and stuff settles in.
Mm-hmm.
But, So,
so you're just breaking even.
Just breaking even. And my contract, I had specific advertising set up within the hotel. And the advertising person in the hotel changed, and all my advertising overnight was taken down. All the stuff on the billboards outside, everything. And it was, and then the ticket brokers, because it was all taken down overnight, thought that my show closed. So now the ticket brokers all of a sudden weren't carrying my show. And it was about the same time that Melinda was coming back into town to work in her, and was negotiating with her brother to work in his show.
Mm-hmm.
And he went to the ticket brokers and said, if you sell her show, I'm going to pull all of my shows. Well, they're making a ton of money.
Mm-hmm.
From his shows.
The brokers were, yes.
Yeah.
Because they had a special deal then also, wasn't that right?
Yep. And so I went from breaking even to selling two or three tickets. It was crazy. It was crazy. And it was just that trifecta of everything happening at once.
Wow. Well, perfect storm all coming together and not being perfect for you.
Yeah.
That's unfortunate. So, yeah, with the, I can't imagine that if you had a deal with the Westin and then the advertising person changes, they didn't even discuss that with you. It's just kind of like the next morning, it's like, well, where's my poster? How come I'm not advertised on the marquee, et cetera?
So I go into the Westin offices and I say, hey, look, this is in my contract. And they said, well, we've already changed it out and we've already paid for the cranes and everything, and we're not going to change them back for another month or so. And I said, I can't afford to carry my show for a month or so, you know, and pay you guys the rent and everything else. And I said, you need to change this back right now. And they refused. So,
despite the contract.
Yep.
So you would have had to spend a lot.
Take us to court.
Yeah. Take us to court.
Yeah. They didn't care. So I, you know, after another 2-3 weeks, I ended up having to close the show.
Man, what a sad story. That probably isn't unusual in Las Vegas either.
It's not. Yeah, you hear these stories all the time. And it's really sad because Vegas used to be the entertainment capital of the world, mm-hmm. and it is no longer. It is now the rental capital of the world.
The rental capital. Wow. Yeah, I've heard that before, that if you're going to be going in and having a show, that you need to have deep pockets or someone who's really going to be a big investor in order to pay for that run for at least 6 months.
Right.
That's kind of what I'd heard. And you're still going to be losing money, even if you have a one-man show. And so it's got to be very difficult because it used to be, again, you were talking about like the big acts, let's say back in the days of Frank Sinatra and everything, people would be coming in to see that. But then also they did a certain amount of time. And if you went a minute over, they would start to deduct your contract or money from the contract.
So, well, okay, right. That is the Wayne Newton Clause.
Okay.
That's what it's called. It's the Wayne Newton Clause. It's called the Wayne Newton Clause because Wayne Newton would go in to do an hour show, and 2.5 hours later, he would still be on stage singing.
Okay.
And so the casinos, to get him, because they only want you in the show for an hour, hour and a half, if it's a big star, and then they want you out in the casino gambling.
Right.
And so
that's where they're making their money. It's not off the ticket prices. It's off of the machines and the
right.
tables.
And so with Wayne Newton, you know, they'd say, hey, you need to keep your show tight. And so what they did was, to get him to keep his show tight, they started charging him for every minute he went over.
Hmm.
And that's what forced Wayne Newton to do shows. But that's what they call it, the Wayne Newton Clause.
But is that still enforced today if you're doing
yes.
a four wall? Even
yep.
with four walls?
Yeah. So, but they have a different way of enforcing it. Because now with four walls, they sell that theater and they sell it to 3 or 4 different shows. So they'll have a show at noon and they pay to be there at noon. And then they've got a show at 4 o'clock and they pay to be there at 4 o'clock. And then they've got a 6 o'clock show. And then mm-hmm. they've got like an 8 or 9 o'clock show. And so you have to have all your stuff out so that the next show has the stage space to do their show.
Make room for them to load in and remove their things from the wings as well. It sounds
yep.
kind of like Branson, because I remember talking with David Sandy about that and how that they have breakfast, lunch, and afternoon shows as well as evening shows, and they have to pay, cover the nut, basically, to rent whatever the space is, and that if it's not making money during those times, other places are, so you might as well book these acts in. So it's just busy, and people are rolling in and out throughout the day.
Yep. And that's why there's no quality control, because a casino doesn't care. They just want to know that you have the money to pay the rent.
Right. That's just another revenue stream for them, basically, where they are renting just another room, basically.
Right.
Huh. So they really don't care whose name's on the marquee out front, because that's not why people are coming into their casino.
Right. And they should care.
Well, I mean, you do have a few names like Celine Dion or whomever, or Elton John, when they've had these larger rooms. And, of course, there are people that have larger, well, Cirque du Soleil contract and Chris Angel or David Copperfield. And there are, but probably just a handful of, quote, names that will bring people into that casino hotel.
Right. And so, like, my show at the Fitzgeralds was one of the last paid shows. We were paid to be there.
Okay.
You know, as far as like, they call them the A-list shows and then the B-list shows. So as far as B-list shows, I was one of the last B-list shows to be paid.
Interesting. And that would have been probably around 2010 or so. So it's been a while back since that was the case. Now you've got some new projects. Here we are in 2020 as we talk right now, some of which you might be able to talk about and some you can't. I know you got the book you're working on.
I have the book I'm working on. I have the cooking show.
Yes. It's an online cooking show, which is Ariane Black's Magic Kitchen.
Yep.
Yep.
Let's see, what can I talk about?
Are you just being coy because of contractual reasons or just not wanting to jinx things or both?
Contractual reasons.
Okay. Okay. Fair enough.
But I'm working on some theater productions.
Okay. It is magic related.
Yeah. And so I might just be the magic consultant, which I'm okay with that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I'm working on some big theater productions. So it's really exciting. It's
kind of like what really Joni Spina had done, where Joni had done a lot of consulting and things and working with the choreography of the acts and how she can improve. So you do that kind of thing too.
No, I don't. So when I say theater productions, I'm coming in just as the magic consultant, kind of like
Charlie Reynolds.
Thank you. Charlie Reynolds.
Okay. Yeah. Gotcha. Okay. Very good.
Yeah.
Well, listen, I appreciate the time that you've given us and a lot of interesting information, particularly about the ladies in magic and history. That's fascinating. I wish you good luck on that book coming out. And also the other person who's working on the independent book, which will be different from that. And obviously that you can get a lot of information, I guess, would be from the Conjurers Art Society there through Ask Alexander and then going to the American Museum of Magic and doing some research. And I'm sure you've used all the resources you can.
I am dealing with the Auschwitz Museum. I'm dealing with, I'm dealing with so many crazy, like, museums and libraries, like Library of Congress, libraries over private libraries in Europe, collectors. It's crazy. It's crazy. But it's so much fun.
And rewarding,
let me
just
say that the museum in Michigan with Jeff.
Yeah, which is the American Museum of Magic.
Yep. They've been extremely helpful.
Good. I know that they have a lot of resources there and just files full of stuff that
boxes.
You can go through.
They have boxes in the basement that they haven't even opened. Every once in a while, he'll send me a little message because he's opened up a box and said, "Hey, guess what I found?"
I know Jeffrey Allen is really passionate about magic and he loves what he does there. And so it's that's cool because I could imagine when he's opening something, it just seems like Christmas. And it's like, oh, well, this is quite a surprise. And so then if he's got someone he can share it with like you, that'd be great. That'd be great.
Yeah. Oh, I love getting text messages from him. I'm like, oh, yay.
You know, it's going to be some good news.
Yeah.
Well, as I said, thank you very much. I appreciate that, Ariane, that you've been my guest here today. And I always like to close because the name of my podcast is called The Magic Word. And I'd like to know what it is that is my guest's philosophy of life. What is your magic word or phrase, something that you live by? What is your thing that keeps you going?
You know, with magic, I love the fact that the impossible is possible. And so I love teaching people, especially people who aren't magicians, that the impossible is possible. And when people see that and that recognition on their face, it's amazing. It's truly amazing. It's like an aha moment for them when they realize that nothing's impossible. So I love that. That's one of the philosophies I live by. But the other philosophy that I discovered in the past, 5 years, is Maya Angelou's quote of, "When somebody shows you who they are, believe them the first time."
I like that.
Yeah.
Believe them the first time. Interesting. Well, Ariane, thank you very much. This has been marvelous. I've enjoyed our time together, and I'm sure the listeners have enjoyed it and learned a lot from you then as well.
It's been so much fun. I love talking to you, Scott.
Thanks a lot. Look forward to our next conversation. Until next time, that was Ariane Black. This is Scotty out.
Bye.
Thank you, Ariane, very much for being my guest this week on the Magic Word Podcast. I really enjoyed speaking with you, and I look forward also to seeing your upcoming book on the women magicians from the past. It sounds like a pretty fascinating coffee table book, and I know that you will have much success with that then as well. Well, I want to invite everybody again to make sure that you sign up for the Yankee Gathering 2020, which is sponsored by the New England Magic Collectors Association. That's NEMCA.com. In fact, that's where you will go, is NEMCA, N-E-M-C-A.com, in order to register for this weekend's online convention. It's only $25 for 2 days of a lot of activities, and sounds like just a whole lot of fun then as well. So go check it out and check out being there this weekend. It's just coming around the corner. And also be sure and sign up for our weekly pod letter. That gives you an opportunity to find out who is on from week to week and who is who perhaps you may have missed in the archives, with some little gentle suggestions on some people that you might want to go back and hear then again. Also, I have one last thing, and I would really encourage you, if at all possible, if you have the time, and hopefully you do right now, is to go to the iTunes store, or if you're an Apple user, or I guess to the Google Play store, but wherever that you get your podcasts, if there is some way that you can leave a 5-star comment, that would be greatly appreciated. I just wanted to read you one I just recently had received, and it says, Scott has been doing these podcasts for years, and they've never disappointed. I've never seen him at a magic convention when he doesn't have some big name magician in a corner with a mic in his face. Same for airports, hotels, bars, etc. Scott works hard at getting interviews for us, and he always delivers. Well, thank you very much. That was a very nice 5-star comment, and I appreciate my listener for posting that. And if you've got something nice to say, I would be greatly appreciate that as well, and also help further our podcast and let other people know about this as well. I'm always surprised that with such a small magic community that we have, that I'm still finding a lot of people who have not yet heard of this podcast. So if you want to help somebody who might be new to magic, this is a good place for them to get started. If you know someone who's been around magic for a long time, this is a good place for them to come also, to listen to the archives and listen to stories from a lot of magic's greats and some people who you may not have known until after you've listened to the podcast, and then you will have made a new friend. Well, we've got a lot more content coming up in future weeks, and so until then, stay well, get booked, and remember that nothing is impossible. This is Scotty out.